and you didn't talk to anyone?
No. No, I was too disassociated to talk about it anyway.
Did you write in a journal, or did you? Was there any way that you were able to kind of record this or process it?
I didn't start remembering any of this stuff until I was 20.
Oh, that's interesting. So what period are we talking about that you remembered, and what period was amnesiac, if you see what I mean? Like, how long was this going on, and then how long a period of just suppressing memory of it?
It all started to stop by the time, like, I was, like, 14 or 15. And the whole time that it happened, I thought I was just some fat kid who really couldn't get attention anyway else, so I would have sex with a kid down the street because it was my fault. And then when I hit 20, 21 years old, I was like, holy shit, I think I was sexually abused by these people. And that started, like, this journey of trying to put myself back together.
So did you experience memories coming back into awareness, or was it just that there were things you hadn't really let yourself think about or kind of understand the implications of that you were willing to actually say, oh, that was what that was? And
well, I think it was all of the above.
It's a weird thing. I mean, this is why I'm asking it in that weird way, because I know people who've, and I guess I've had maybe a bit of this experience, but not much, people who, they never really forgot what happened. They just somehow didn't let themselves see the implications of it.
Exactly, yeah. I think I'm one of those people. It's like, you know, my last therapist, they're like, she's like, do any of your parts have names? And I'm like, nope. I just disassociated it. You know, I just did not, I refused to let myself believe what was really happening to me. I had no concept of it.
Why did she ask you that question about parts, though?
Because I do have parts, but I don't think I'm so broken up that I have different people. It's like I'm just, like, the furniture in the room hasn't really been brought together in an orderly fashion. You know?
Okay, so, I mean, because you jump from the memory thing to, I mean, obviously I understand why, but many people might not. They went from sort of the way that we compartmentalize memories so that we don't really look at them to fragmentation. So, and that is essentially what fragmentation is, of course, is compartmentalization of memory. And it's occurring to me that would be one way. Another way to describe what I was saying is if there was a part of you that kind of retained the memory of being sexually abused, but had its own interpretation of it,
right,
which was not as abuse, but self-blaming, let's say.
Yes.
Then whenever that memory was coming into awareness, you would switch into that altar that would be saying,
yeah,
you did it, it's your fault.
Yes, exactly. Nice, very nicely done. Yeah. Good on you, man. That was, I'm pretty impressed.
Well, I'm just trying to, you know, because one can easily imagine the extreme examples of this where it's really the part that remembers is saying nothing happened.
Right.
So the part that remembers is not telling you, but
right,
it's still there, right?
Right. I created this part of my personality that took all the blame for it, that, you know, made myself, I had to become something to handle it, basically. It's like I just took all the blame on, and I just turned it into something else.
Which would be something you wanted to do, I guess, would be a big part,
right,
of it. Like, you wanted to stick the rusty knife up this guy's ass, therefore something wrong with you.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, because there was so much shit coming so hard and fast, I think we dissociate, like I've learned from people, that we dissociate to survive. It's a defense mechanism, you know? That's all we got is babies, you know?
Babies?
Well, as
oh, as babies, right. Yeah, I see. So it's all we got is babies. So.
No, it's all we got is young children. You know, we don't have any other tools but to just go away, you know, and create this other reality of what we think is going on, you know.
And are there any concrete ties to the military base? Is it just that it was there and therefore you're deducing reasonably enough that there was some connection?
Well, it's really funny to me that, you know, here's this military base. After the war, 80 so-called German scientists went there.
Wow.
Yeah, we all know about that. And
yeah.
And there was, like I said, these towns were so radically different from each other. And all the kids that grew up around that town and around that military base really had a lot of the same stories. You know, a lot of very sadistic sexual overtones. A lot of suicide. You know, a lot of very deviated sexual practices. And I just find that very, very interesting, you know.
And are there any military people in your family, extended family at all?
Well, a lot of my uncles fought in World War II. And that's about it, you know. But, you know, this kid's family had all kinds of connections to people. You know, there was a lot of money there. They worked at, you know, there were horse stables around that fort, and a lot of people connected to that military base owned them and worked on them, and they were always there doing something. You know, they had a really, my nephew told my cousin not that long ago that they had this really expensive dark room in their basement. And yet when you walked into their house, there was no, you know, there was really no pictures up, you know.
Right. And how did your nephew know about the dark room?
He just came out with it to my cousin not too long ago. He, you know, after all these years, he just came out of the, you know. And it's just a really, really big, convoluted story.
Is there any evidence that they were making child porn then?
Yeah. Besides the dark room, me and my cousin, just to back up, it's like I'm really lucky I've got my cousin because he helps me sort this stuff out, you know? If I didn't have somebody who went there with me, I don't know where I'd be, you know.
And whose child is he?
He is my mother's sister's son.
So, okay, so right, on the opposite side to the cousin that was babysitting you.
Exactly.
Right.
So, when this kid used to do things with me, it would always have to be in secret. You know, wait till my parents go to bed or when nobody's around, this is what we're going to do. Whereas any time he got a hold of my cousin, his parents were home. They would always have to be in plain sight with the door open, and there was holes in the bedroom walls. So either they were watching or somebody was filming something or both. So it was a complete opposite of what happened with me.
So, what does your cousin think then about that, about his parents and their complicity?
His parents and their complicity. I don't think our parents. I think something happened to our mothers with this family, and it terrified them so bad that they just went along with it and
Okay.
closed their eyes and just hoped that everything would go away because they were too scared to deal with it. That's where complicity is.
And why do you think that this the little cult leader that was abusing you and your cousin, why were the different rules for the two of you? Like you're saying, he was more secretive with you.
Well, two things, because I live close to his house, and I think to his mother and father, I would have been more of a risk.
Because of your father's connections.
Because of just my father and the whole neighborhood finding out. But with my cousin, they could not keep themselves, they couldn't turn down the profit.
They couldn't turn down the profit. You know, they couldn't resist the profit they could make.
Yeah, because I was a few years younger than my cousin, and I was a fat kid, whereas my cousin was a little bit more grown up, right around the same age as their son. He looked really good. He fit that type. If you've done any study on child pornography, it's like to get a video of two kids around the same age that look good having sex together, you're going to make bank from that.
Right. Yeah, well, so it does sound, what you're describing does sound like it includes the intersection of some of the usual suspects, doesn't it?
It
The
does.
mafia, child pornography, military bases. And you've said, I mean, obviously you say you don't want to mention names or town names or anything like this, but the research that you've done, have you uncovered anything that does point to this area?
Yeah, there was a, again, this town is only 5 square miles long. When I was a kid in the 80s, it was like 88. I was just getting 87, 88. I was like junior, senior year in high school. About 2 years before that, right next to the military base, a daycare center was opened up. Now, this was height of satanic panic. This place was raided and they had video cameras in there. They were molesting all the kids. The one thing I specifically remember there was they were filming everything.
Really?
And
So this,
I'm sorry, sir. Go ahead.
this was actually, is that on record, and that it was confirmed, and so no panic, just satanic kind of case?
I don't know if it was satanic. It wasn't satanic panic stuff, and here's why. Because only people who knew about it were the people who lived in that town. There was
So it didn't get into the media.
never got into the media. I remember the girl Gina, she told me about it and a few other people. They were just like, wow, that daycare center, the police were there, they were this, they were that. What the hell? What's going on? It was a daycare center. And then as soon as it happened, it was over. It was over.
And
They shut the place down.
is there anything about it online at all?
I looked everywhere. My cousin looked everywhere. And hopefully, maybe we'll find something one day. Or when I go back home, maybe I'll talk to somebody and see if I can find out anything. And this was right by that military base. And I specifically remember saying a lot of military kids were being sent there because they had a place to go during the day.
Wow.
Yeah. And there's way more. I mean, I could talk to you for like 5 fucking hours.
Well, we still, we've got half an hour anyway, so
I'm just
what
joking.
else? What else you got?
Well, again, they're going back to the situation between me and my cousin. It was like you know, the stuff that he did to us, the way he was able to manipulate us so well. Somebody had to teach him that.
Yeah.
And I find, I mean, it's like I said, I mean, he was like a mini Charles Manson. It's like, I'm not saying that to make a joke. It's like, if you really read about the manipulative skills that Charles Manson had, it's almost uncanny how much they had in common. And I'm not a professional researcher. You know, I'm not like you or Jan Ervin or any, I just did research to find out about myself, you know, and, you know, I just find it amazing, like, how he would abuse me one way and then he would abuse my cousin another way, where all the doors had to be open, the lights had to be on, and everything had to be in full view.
With your cousin, you mean?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, his parents were always home when it happened. It's crazy, you know.
And how are you relating that to the manipulation and the mind control, or are you not?
I actually am. I'm struggling with the right words, you know. It's like, how could this kid have so much power? You know, how could he be so good at what he did?
Were there any occult signifiers that you or your cousin noticed, symbols or names or belief systems?
Yeah. He was very, I don't think he basically came from an occult magic type family, but I think they worked for people who were.
Hmm. Why'd you think that?
Because right by that military base is a wildlife preserve, a forest preserve. And he always used to hang around there. And the first story I heard about that place was from a friend of my cousin. This guy was a high school wrestler. He got out. He wrestled in college. Big Italian kid, really nice kid. Another one of those kids, you know, his family went to church on Sunday, and that was it. So he wasn't on some type of mission to, like, defeat the devil or tell people about the devil or anything like that. He used to work out after work. And he used to work out with his buddy from this hardware store that he worked at. And they would run from the hardware store home a couple miles. So they would always run through this wildlife preserve, and it was usually like around 11:30 at night. So one night he's running with his buddy, and all of a sudden they see light in the preserve. And they slow down. And they start going, holy shit, they see a fire. And they start slowing down more. And they stop and they hide. Because they look and there's about 25 people in robes standing around a fire, doing whatever they do. You know, they said that they heard people talking in like a chant like thing. And we found that out, and they said that they were so terrified, and then they said that they must have made a noise or something like that, and they were chased out of that, out of the woods. And they said that they thought that they were going to die. And Tony was a tough guy. Like, he would take on all comers. He said that he had never been so terrified in his whole life. And it was like 25 people around in a circle in front of a fire with robes on.
Were they trying to catch them, do you think, or were they just trying to scare them?
That I don't know, but they were going after him pretty hard. He said they were sprinting out of those woods, man.
You sound like yours anyway. Come on, scared out, relax. Nothing's yours anyway. Come, what's your noise, your little voice? It's the only way to relax. As I go, I weigh you, my vest of safety, my special friend. You're all around, all the better to see you with. Come, what's your noise, your little voice? It's the
But as far as your experience with the mini cult leader, you don't remember any specific occult references or
not any occult, but occult behavior.
Yeah,
because his personality was that of a manipulator, and this is where I could go off the rails here. But if you think about stories about Crowley, Charles Manson, Damien Echols. So many things that you hear about the more darker forms of the occult, it's all based on retaining that power to get out of people to do what the fuck you want to do. Or is that not correct? You know?
Well, it's a very general description, of course, because, I mean, in society, that's what people are doing, and, you know, figuring out ways to manipulate others in order to increase their own personal power. That's kind of society and the world as we know it. And it's certainly occultism in essence, but
some of it.
It doesn't mean that there are actually occult methods or symbols being applied, right? So, I mean, that's something that you might not have noticed, or it simply might not be the case, but it would be interesting. I mean, like, were you aware of this guy's interests besides power and control, like what he was into?
He would get really upset and angry, because when I was a kid, I didn't have a problem going to church. You know, when I thought about Jesus, I'm like, yeah, that makes me feel good. You know, so he was not very happy with that shit. You know, like, I remember after, like, one of the first nights, something really bad happened, and he's like, where's your God now, motherfucker? And I'm not saying that he was studying Satanism or this or that. I'm just saying the vitriol that he had for a belief in God or Jesus was really, really palpable. If he could have just got me to stop believing in God or believing in Jesus, he would have been happy. And
interesting.
Yeah, and believe me, man, I've lived a pretty well-lived life. I've met Buddhists, I've met magicians, I've met people that were Wiccans. I don't have any issue with that. You know, I'm an Orthodox Christian, but I realize that people believe in different things. I welcome people who are atheists, or I don't care. It's not going to stop me from, or I should say, it's not going to make me get a personal grudge. You know, you understand where I'm coming from? I just don't have any stock in, you know, trying to convince people that he was some evil occultist kid. But I find it interesting that he was so, you know, he was so turned off by the thought of a god. Or a Christian.
It's definitely. And ostensibly his parents would have been Christian, like in their public persona, I imagine, would have been Christian.
They never professed a belief in anything, you know.
They didn't go to church or anything like that, as far as you know.
Nope, nothing like that. But again, in that little town, like, there's the story about this wrestler stumbling on these people with robes, but everybody had stories about all the wooded areas. You would find all this you know, esoteric or whatever you want to call it, you would find all this symbolism. You would find dead animal bones. You would find, like, if there was a deserted building in the woods, you would find, like, symbols written on the walls. There was only one time when I was a kid I found a 666 carved into the tree with an upside down cross, and it had wax melted into it. But that was the only specific, you know, what we call modern satanic symbol. Everything else was stuff that it looked like fucking hieroglyphics. Mm. But it was all over this little 5-square-mile town. And once you went into another town, you didn't see any of that shit. Nothing.
And did you guys talk about it? Like, did it create a kind of sense of mystery and rumor? And...
Yes. Yeah, it did.
So what were the rumors about it? I mean, were you talking about weird devil worshippers? Or
yeah, what was be that like, happening? Wow, there was, you know, there must be some Satan worshippers or devil worshippers in the woods. Oh, it's really scary. Don't go in there, you know.
Right, local folklore.
Yeah, it was local folklore, but again, we weren't raised like some of the more extreme parts of Christianity. It wasn't like we were on some mission to, you know, cast the devil out of our lives, you know. My cousin read the Satanic Bible when we were kids, you know. It just, all I remember is like a high level of fear. You know,
high level of what?
Fear, you know, just constant fear all the time.
So do you mean, I mean, because of what you describe, it's understandable that you'd have been in a high level of constant fear, but do you mean more than just that, like a general feeling in the neighborhood?
Yes, it's something that's driven me crazy my whole life. Is like, I think there was an extremely evil presence in my life, and I think possibly there was very powerful people that were harnessing that. And, you know, you could go into the MK Ultra thing or this or that. It's just funny to me that in this little town with all this weird looking cult activity, you have a military base that was working on very, very high-level military technology with 80 Nazi scientists working there, who said that they were scientists.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything in the history books about that, about that military base?
Yeah, there is, and I could definitely share that with you in a more private way.
So, and you're, where are you now? You're not still in the town, I presume.
No.
No,
I'm in Tennessee.
Tennessee. Oh yeah, you mentioned that at the beginning. So you. But of course, these things don't. You can't necessarily leave them behind. They can follow you wherever you go. Of course. So, essentially, you're understandably concerned now that the people that were involved in whatever was happening back then are still active and operational, or at least the groups are. Yeah. Sorry, say that again.
They could be. I think what me and my cousin experienced was like one little piece of a long film reel. To me, it's no different than some of the things that you discussed and that you studied, but just one little piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this kid was just a byproduct of all that shit. And we just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. I didn't meet any celebrities. I didn't meet any, you know, high-level politicians that wanted to take me in their fucking suite or anything like that. You know, I just know that it's very strange to me that in this small little 5-square-mile town, there was that kind of shit going on in a military base, and everywhere you went that was off the beaten path, you had all this symbolism and all these strange stories and all these kids committing suicide and, you know, former intelligence officers that were all living around there whose kids were completely fucked up. I mean, I could just go on and on.
Did you know any of these kids that suicided?
I knew of them. I knew one girl kind of well. This kid that I talk about, Manson Jr., you know, one of his friends killed himself with an exercise machine.
How do you do that?
He like wired it around his door and it was on a spring, and then he wrapped it around his neck and triggered something and it just snapped his neck.
Wow, that's pretty elaborate.
Yeah, creative.
Yeah. So how many suicides are we talking about here then, when you were growing up?
There was at least 4 that I know of. At least 4, which is pretty big for that town.
And did you ever get a sense, or has it occurred to you that you were being trained for something as opposed to just victimized?
I think that, and this is just hypothetical on my part, I think his parents probably never wanted him to even go near me. But by that time, they had already created such a monster that if they said something about it, then there was going to be a fear of everybody finding out. So I think this kid was just doing what he was taught to do, and he was probably trying to groom me for something. But I was the wrong one to do it to. So there might have been a point to it. There might have not have been. Maybe he was just repeating learned behavior. Or there might have been like, well, let's see how this goes.
Right.
No.
And when did you first start speaking about your experiences?
My first therapist, I was 24 years old when I got a therapist, but we basically just talked about, you know, I was molested by this kid, this A, B, and C happened, and I'm sad. And I have very little tools to survive. And go ahead.
I was just going to ask, you kind of answered it there, but why you went to therapy in the first place? Like, what kind of state you were in at 24?
Well, I was a professional musician at the time. I was only really useful when I was on stage. And when I would get off stage, I would just feel I couldn't get out of bed. I had really hard time performing basic tasks. I felt what I understand now is highly disassociated.
Like unreal, disconnected.
Constantly, all the time. It's just now that I'm starting to really, really put myself together. So at that time, I just knew I was fucked up. You know, I mean, I wasn't on any dope or drinking a lot or anything like that. I would just, like you said, I would feel unreal all the time. You know, and once I got on stage and started playing guitar, that's when I felt good. But that only lasted a few hours. And then after that was over, I would fall apart and hide it. And then I finally started to get some help when I was on the verge of, and I had a nervous breakdown. I remember it clear as day. I was in my apartment with my girlfriend at the time, and I literally went to the ground and just started screaming, like just.
Was there a trigger? Something that happened?
Not that I can remember at the time. I think we were having a disagreement about something, and I knew that I wasn't being very good to her, you know, and I felt like I had a whole lot of shit to hide. And then, like I said, I just went to the ground, and I think I lost about 15 pounds in 1 week. Like, I was kind of filled out, and like by the end of the week, my cheeks were hollow. None of my clothes fit anymore. You know,
this was before you started therapy.
I'm sorry.
This is what led to you seeing a therapist?
Yeah, I actually made contact with a therapist. I didn't go for a little while, and then that happened, and then I never stopped going.
So when you say never stop going, what do you mean? Like, how long were you in therapy from 24 until now? Like, how much time have you been in therapy?
From when I was 24 up until now, I think collectively I've spent about 9 years in therapy.
with different therapists.
Yes. Different therapists, and different lengths of time, and, you know.
And the first one, how long did that last?
About 2 years.
And why did you stop?
Because I moved. I felt like I moved out of the state that I was living in. I felt like I had, you know, got a lot. I learned a lot. I felt like I got a little healthier, you know, and I was still not remembering all this stuff. You know, I still was, my body and mind wasn't allowing me to, or mostly my mind wasn't allowing me to get to this stuff.
When you say this stuff, like what percentage would you say that you've talked about today in terms of what you think happened to you?
I think there's a lot more. You know, I think like I could tell you a lot more detailed, connected stuff if we had more time or if we talked at another time. Like, yeah. To me, this is just an icebreaker.
Sure. So, like, I mean, okay, so there's two things. One is what you remember. There may be stuff you don't remember. But in terms of what you remember, like, what percentage would you say that you've shared today? Like 10%, 50%?
To highball it a little bit, about 10%.
Right. So there's a lot that you remember that you haven't talked about, and then possibly the stuff you don't remember.
Yes.
And when you were 24 or 26, after you came out of therapy, you say you still didn't remember stuff. So compared to what you remember now, you had just a percentage of that then.
I had as much as I could handle.
And were you, I mean, this is a delicate question, you don't have to go into details, but I think, I mean, it's obviously relevant, you will know why when I say it. Were you able to function in a sexual relationship for most of your adult life, would you say? Or how satisfied were you with your functionability?
Unfortunately for me, I was highly functional.
Yeah, so he's just talking about, okay, because I didn't want you to think I was talking about being able to maintain a hard on there. I meant as in a healthy sexual relationship of intimacy, the whole thing, the whole gamut, not just performing.
Unfortunately, I was very high performance, and I had very, very little intimacy for a long time.
So would that result in lots of short-term relationships?
Lots of short-term relationships, but to be more concrete, I tried to fuck my problems away.
Okay, so prostitutes, one-night stands,
never in prostitutes, but just a lot of availability.
Right.
A lot of availability, unfortunately. And, just I tried to fuck my problems away. And...
Well, I mean, that's a good subject for, you know, maybe for another chat, of course. I come from that kind of background myself, never been my way, but I brought it up because of, well, if we're going to talk about at all, and we've even just touching on the cost, you know, the toll that this kind of trauma takes, I think it's nowhere more palpable and tangible and tragic than just in the way that it sabotages our capacity for sexual intimacy.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I wholeheartedly agree with that. And it feels good to agree with that. You know, that's a whole nother story. You know?
Well, this might seem a bit frivolous, but it's making me think of Jan Irvin and his I think he's a bit out there with it's a bit cerebral for him, but when he talks about a man and a woman coming together and fucking and how that's God and, you know, this primal connection. You know, I agree in essence with what he's saying there, even though I don't think it has to be turned into something spiritual and highfalutin the way he wants to. But basically, I mean, you talk about dissociation and feeling unreal, like that it seems that one of the ways that we can be most embodied, most connected, most alive is through that sexual intimacy with another, you know, with this loving and lustful connection.
Right.
And so if that gets hijacked and sabotaged, as it was in my case, it really it's such a huge hole. It's like a big piece of my life has been ripped out, you know. And I'm just, I mean, it's not really result oriented. Like I try not to gauge how effective my healing process is by that or by anything else, but nonetheless, I can still constantly refer to that. Like in many ways, my life, it seems to be really functioning well, even though I know that I've got this unhealed trauma and unintegrated stuff in the past. Even despite that, I can say that in most ways, I have a really good, fully functioning life.
Right.
But until I think about that, you know, I'm married. I really love my wife. We're very close, but I'm afraid, you know, I'm afraid of being sexual and of sexuality and that whole thing. It's just so much fear around it. And I know that's not natural. There's a reason for that. It's not just the culture, and there's something really deep there that has been put in me. And, you know, if you want to sabotage a human being, that's the way to do it.
Yes.
You know? Install them with fear around the most basic human, you know, experience that there is.
Yeah, I agree. And I could, you know, and I appreciate you telling me that you're afraid. I mean, that takes a lot to say that. And I can honestly say that I'm the same way. I mean, I'm afraid of so much every day. And I have a, you know, a wonderful relationship. And I'm still scared. I mean, I think a lot of times with Jan Ervin, it just boils down to delivery. He's right about a lot of shit, but at the same time, it's like he could use some social skills. you know, who cares? You know, it's like my point is that it takes a lot of balls to admit to another man that, like, fuck, I'm scared, dude. But when you do that, that's when reality comes out. And I think we have a responsibility to ourselves to own that part of us.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever journey that takes, take the fucking journey. Take that fucking journey. You know?
It's like you were mentioning the parts earlier, and well, it was the question about names, but I mean, one's parts don't necessarily need to have names to have some sort of discrete existence in us that, you know, is a result of our fragmentation. And what they do need, I think, if not to be named, is to be given a voice.
Right.
So there's a part in me that is afraid of these things, and the controlling alter doesn't want that part to be heard, and it doesn't want to have it speak through it or me, you know.
Right.
Like it is uncomfortable for us to say certain things, which is equivalent, I think, to letting certain parts have a voice.
Right.
But if they don't have a voice, they'll never be heard, and they'll never be able to feel acknowledged by the whole, you know, to experience themselves as part of the whole psyche.
Right. And I think the incredible thing that happens between us when we speak is, you know, I talked a lot and you had to do a lot of listening. And the funny thing is that the process of it, you're able to pinpoint that and describe it way better than I can. Whereas I seem like I'm kind of tumbling through the details, you kind of see the end goal a little bit better than me. And it's just a matter of whether you can take those statements that you're forming, which are very correct, and just allow yourself to dig a little deeper and let that be what it is. And because everything you're saying, I'm experiencing, you know, that whole thing of your alter's not letting you speak the truth or feel the truth. Because feeling the truth is very important. Because I know for a fact, like you said, I was a big guy. It's like I'm finally starting to be okay with my body, you know, to let my body do what it does best. I've had numerous panic attacks while I was working out because I'm opening up all these harmed and traumatized parts in my body that have been just dormant for years. And I go do a deadlift and I'm like, because a feeling's coming back.
Oh, that's interesting. Body memory.
Yeah. I'm like, I got to stop working out. I'm going to die. And my girlfriend's like, no, hold on a minute.
Have you considered yoga? Yeah, I want to see a local yoga class.
Maybe, yeah. I've actually thought about one day maybe doing that. Seriously.
You'd be out of your element, which is often a good thing.
Yeah, I think it's definitely something in the cards for the future. You've mentioned that before about how our body holds on to the. And you're absolutely right. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah, because I was surprised that you're saying working out would help those stuff to move, because working out just seems so proactive and whatnot, and it doesn't seem like it would be therapeutic, but I'm not ruling it out. But I think at the very least, and what I notice about yoga is, because it compels us to put our attention on the body,
yeah,
that alone allows stuff to start stirring, you know, into consciousness and coming into consciousness, and that can be very uncomfortable. But so I would say that yoga is, well, maybe it wouldn't be a good idea, because it might be even more distressing to you, but it could also be more therapeutic. What was I going to say? Because it's very gentle.
Yes.
So actually, it's quite strange of how much discomfort I can experience in yoga, because I'm not really, like with working out, you really are making the body do something that it hasn't done and has to learn to do. Whereas with yoga, it's trying to just get back to how it once was when it was a child.
Sure.
So in that regard, it's the tension in the body that's getting addressed in yoga is a tension, in my opinion, that's directly related to trauma.
Yeah. It might be more of a direct focused way of doing it, whereas maybe this happened to me by chance. But you know, I don't know if you've ever done something like a deadlift before, but you really have to focus, and you really have to have like a proper posture when you do it. I'm not saying like yoga, but the principle is kind of the same. You have to have your body form the right way. You have to focus your concentration right, because you know, doing five sets of 235 pounds or 250 pounds, you better make sure that your body's planted the right way. You know, and so when I would do stuff like that, I've learned about myself that I hold all my trauma in my non-dominant side, especially around my hip and my side area. Mm-hmm. And you know, there was a lot of times where, you know, learning how to engage my hips and get that moving was really difficult for me. And just to close that out, I think I need to feel distress.
I know, yeah. Well, there isn't a way through without it.
Right.
I would agree. It doesn't mean that you want to overdo it, of course.
No, of course not. But I mean, to, you know, that's what I've learned the past 2 years, is that, you know, feeling distress, anxiety, feeling like I'm going to die at any minute, having anxiety attack after anxiety attack, is just what I needed, because it was my body waking up, my consciousness waking
right.
up. You know, walks, you know, but that's how it's got to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have me on speaker, by the way?
Yes, you're coming out of my phone.
So your partner's been listening to this whole conversation?
She's in the other room.
Yeah. No, because I became aware of it at a certain point walking around, and then so it's okay. I don't have a problem with it, but it's kind of unusual.
I'm sorry. I probably should have said something.
I don't actually have a problem with it.
Yeah, but
it's just going to be a podcast.
it was kind of rude of me not to say that, not totally.
No, it wasn't. I mean, not in my rule book, anyway.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm glad you said that, because I was like, oh, shit, I wasn't even thinking.
That's your social anxiety coming out now, I think.
Well, you're entitled.
I'm entitled to what?
Having a little social anxiety with this subject. Jesus.
Oh, one is, you mean? You said you are, so. No, but I mean, I've noticed this, that you're very, you have a lot of anxiety about doing the wrong thing.
Yes, very much so. Very much so.
Yeah, well, you don't have to worry about that with me. Not because you can't, but because I'm very direct about that.
That's good.
Yeah.
I appreciate you saying that, because it's a big thing that I've been working on for a long time. And I think it translates back into, you know, that's the part of me that I somehow formed possibly to survive this whole thing was taking the blame for everything.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah, we all have that, I think, to one degree or another. I know I certainly do. That, as in, I'm shit. No, you did it wrong. You fucked up again. That program in us. I think everybody can relate to that. But it's particularly strong for some of us, and I think related to that early shaming, betrayal, and whatnot.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, you're really good at hitting stuff right on the head. And I think that's amazing for somebody who can't remember so much shit that he has possibly experienced. I mean, that's incredible, you know.
Well, yeah, thanks. It's also a nail that needs to be hit, I think, because that program that's constantly creating anxiety over everything we do is of course makes it impossible to live, and in many ways that's just the one thing we want to get free of, really, isn't it? Is that constant self-judgment.
Yeah, and I guess I focused a lot on me too with this conversation, because and just in general, I don't know what you've remembered for yourself and what you haven't remembered. And
well, yeah.
And I don't want to start asking questions about you that would make you feel so uncomfortable that it would create a bad evening for you or create a bad day. And I know that you're responsible for yourself and all that stuff, but again, it just comes down to normal consideration. But I'm really interested in how you were able to tackle this subject as well as you do. I think you're scaring the shit out of people. I think you really are. But at the same time, you're telling me, and I've heard you say it so many times, that you have holes in what you remember and you don't know what happened to you. And I guess with all my bullshit aside, that's why I'm here, because I feel a kinship. And I'm just going off the cuff here, and I haven't been able to stop thinking about it, and I think about you all the time, and it's really strange.
That is kind of strange. But then I guess if you're listening to my podcast all the time, it's not so strange.
Well, but something's driving me to it, you know.
Yeah. Right. So, well, I guess it's finding a confirmation and validation of your experience. I mean,
yeah.
You know, who I speak to and when is not coincidental, and I don't see it as random. And so me speaking to you today, it's true that I don't have a podcast for Saturday, and this may be that, but I don't really care about that even in the best of times, and particularly not currently. I'm you know, easing off on the pressure to create a podcast. So putting that aside entirely, I was aware that speaking to you had some significance in terms of the timing for me now.
Gotcha.
Because of what I just said to you, as in, it's very hard to find men who are willing to talk about these kinds of experiences, and it's what I do, but then I don't remember it, so I don't have to talk about it, you know. So talking to you, like, I suppose it's potentially it's almost a way to talk to a part of myself that remembers and get the message, or give and get the message that it's okay to talk about it.
Right.
From you.
Right. And yeah, it does, like, the validation thing is true. I mean, yeah, I can talk to you and I could share my experiences, and, you know, you have all the evidence backing so many things. And yes, it is validating, but to me, there's something deeper there. And like I said, if I'm wrong, it's okay. But there's something about you where I'm thinking there's got to be some kind of brotherhood, for lack of a better term. I don't want to get too, but it's the only thing I can think of right now. There's something that you're about how you are that I can really, really relate to.
Because we're, talk about born on opposite sides of the tracks, huh? You and the mob and me and Yorkshire aristocracy.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, but stranger things have occurred, you know.
I mean, if we met at a bar in Manhattan or something, or if we had 20 years ago, we would have probably assumed that we really didn't have much to talk about.
Right. I would agree with that. But you know, who knows?
Well, in fact, we would have done, right? But appearances would have deceived us.
Yeah. And, you know, and I'm so interested in, you know, you actually made, like, a shamanic journey. Again, going back to the research that you've done, like, that thing, I haven't even been able to get through, like, that whole Whitley Strieber story. You know, and that's what I mean about, you probably scare the shit out of people. You know, it's like, you know, what the fuck is this guy doing? You know, he's going to blow the lid off this shit. You know, that's how I feel sometimes. I'm not someone.
Well, I hope you're wrong about that, because probably wouldn't turn out so well for me if I was scaring powerful people.
Or just, you know, that thing about Whitley Strieber, I've always been kind of fascinated by that guy. And I read like maybe a quarter to half of your blog posts, and I'm like, this is right in front of my face. You know, he's describing all this stuff. And then if you listen to, like, I listened to a lot of Whitley Strieber podcasts because he had Peter Lavenda on, and he had Joseph P. Farrell, and I've gained a lot of good information from those guys.
But, or so you think.
Well, what was it that Goebbels said about there has to be a lot of truth in propaganda or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
And that was part of my journey in my healing process of finding people like that and trying to put shit together, you know? Guys like Peter Lavenda, all these guys, I don't know who they are. I don't particularly care, except what information can I put together? Some of it's probably bullshit, some of it's probably not.
Well, it's back to what we talked about at the beginning, that if it doesn't have the, if it's not rooted in personal honesty and experience, then I think it might as well be disinformation, even if it's accurate.
You really think so?
Yeah, I really do.
What do you mean by that?
I was kind of hoping that would just remain as a soundbite that for people to think about, but I guess it's not going to.
Well, we could drop it if you want.
I guess I just mean, and I'll just say it in a different way, that if you're not talking from experience, then you might as well not be talking. I know Lavenda would say he is, because he's been there and he's done that, but that's not the kind of experience I'm talking about. I don't mean, you know, going to the sources and getting it from them. I mean actually talking about a lived encounter with knowledge. And so, yeah, I mean,
got it.
Like, I've written a lot of books before. Just the more recent stuff, I don't consider them to have much value now, because they were stories I was telling myself in order not to remember the truth.
Wow.
So I think that, yeah, most of those guys are just telling stories in order not to remember the truth.
Well, I'm just hanging on what you just said. It was like these books that I wrote and I put all this time and effort into were ways for me not to remember the truth. I mean, that's really, really powerful, you know, and that speaks to me a lot, you know, that I, cause I didn't write books, but I did a lot of things. So I didn't have to deal with the truth, or I was too afraid to deal with the truth.
Well, same, isn't it? Yeah.
In a way.
That's the whole.
In a way.
Could say the whole world is that, of people keeping busy because they're so afraid of what they'll see if they stop.
Maybe. I mean, I think there's some truth in that, but I think it comes down to what we're capable of remembering. And I think that's where genuine healing can start. It's like you, I'm really glad you called me out and said, you know, I don't think you were trying to call me out in that typical sense, but like you said, you know, you have a lot of anxiety about, you know, being wrong or, you know, being immoral or whatever you want to say, but it's cool to hear that because if we're going to get to the healing process, it's like, for me, it's like, sometimes we're incapable of facing the truth because what happened to us was so painful and we were just little boys and we carried that with us and we were just little boys. And I think that gets lost in all this.
Mm.
And we carried those skills that we acquired to get through the fucking day.
Right.
And then
exactly.
As we grow into adulthood, we realize that these very tools that we used are now hurting us. And it's not coming from freedom of choice. It's not coming from being responsible for ourselves. It's just literally we believe that we are not capable of facing the truth or we're going to die or we're going to go off the deep end. You know, and I think we need to give ourselves that. You too.
What are we giving ourselves?
That realization that, you know, it takes a lot of time and a lot of patience and care to get ourselves to face the truth. Because maybe we don't believe that we're equipped. Because any time we faced the truth before, it was like a...
Annihilating.
Yeah. Yeah. Annihilating. There you go.
Yeah, it's true. True words.
Annihilating. So all that other bullshit doesn't matter. It's like, we're just a couple of guys trying to get down to the fucking real thing. Takes a little work.
Well, that could be a tagline for the podcast. Just a couple of guys trying to get down to the real thing.
All right.
Well, it's not always guys, but mostly, unfortunately, for whatever reason.
I think that's a good idea because I think it will honor the fact that we have such a hard time finding other men to relate to. And you just said correctly enough, it's like anytime you go to a group session, there's always a woman there. So we can use that as a banner.